Hi, Laura Murphy Oates here. Just a warning before we start. This episode does contain discussion of sexual abuse and predatory behaviour. We'll be listing some support resources at the end of the episode, but you can also find them on the Full Story page as well. The conviction of R. Kelly may be the most high-profile Me Too case in the music industry worldwide. And in this episode, a replay from our global news podcast, Today in Focus, we hear about the failure of music journalism in covering this case and the way in which Black victim survivors were ignored and denied justice. To be honest, it's not an easy listen. It definitely made me reflect on how we as journalists tell stories, who we listen to, who we take seriously, especially when there are stakes such as money, power, and influence at play. Okay. I'll pass it over to Nosheen Iqbal from the Today in Focus team.
A court in New York has found the American singer R. Kelly guilty of sex trafficking and racketeering. He was convicted of running a scheme to sexually abuse underage girls, boys, and women.
It's been a long time coming. Robert Kelly, the self-declared Pied Piper of R&B, was convicted. More than 20 years since the allegations that he'd been sexually abusing children first emerged. But as Lauren Aretani, who's been covering his trial in New York for The Guardian, explains, Kelly's status made him untouchable.
R. Kelly was this superstar. He was beloved by millions of fans. He had multiple sold-out tours. He was at all the award shows. He sang at the Olympics. All the while, he was continuously abusing young girls and women. And it seems like people knew about this early on.
Kelly was sued multiple times by Black women and girls, but he was never prosecuted. In 2002, police charged him with 21 counts of making child sexual abuse videos. That case took years to come to trial, and Kelly was acquitted. In the meantime, the music industry stood by him, and his career went from strength to strength.
R. Kelly continued to be incredibly popular, super supportive fans, fans that looked up to him. And he used that power and this love that he got from his fans to essentially recruit these young girls and women who looked up to him.
Kelly has always maintained that he's innocent, the victim of groupies who wanted to use him for fame and money.
You feel that people have maligned your character?
I have been assassinated. I have been buried alive.
But now Kelly is facing the possibility of spending the rest of his life in prison. Defeated and depleted in court, he refused to testify. His lawyers denied it all, but the evidence against him told a different story.
The majority of the survivors in this case were people of color. And people of color, especially women of color, are often ignored when they either go to the police or tell people their stories. This is the first time Kelly is actually suffering any type of consequence in court for what he has been doing for decades.
From The Guardian, I'm Nosheen Iqbal. Today in Focus, the conviction of Robert Kelly and the culture that let him get away with it. Lauren Aretani, you're a reporter for Guardian US, and you've been covering the R. Kelly trial in New York day in, day out for the last couple of months. Can you start by telling us exactly what the charges were that R. Kelly was facing?
R. Kelly faced one count of racketeering and 8 violations of the Mann Act.
And for anyone who's followed his story, these seem to be really strange technical charges considering the accusations against him. Why did the prosecution take that route?
Racketeering is often associated with organized crime, criminal enterprise, or illegal schemes. People associated with mobs are usually charged with racketeering. And basically what this allows the prosecution to do is to sweep all these illegal activities that they say Kelly has done. Kidnapping, bribery, these are the acts within the racketeering count. Under one charge, it's a count that carries a sentence of up to 20 years. And so in a way, it allows them to present to the jury if we can prove to you that he committed at least some of these specific acts, then he is guilty.
We've heard women testify that R. Kelly imprisoned, drugged, and raped them. They say that he groomed them and that he subjected them to these degrading punishments if they didn't do what he wanted, and that he sexually abused minors. He's denied those allegations, and they're not the charges he's been convicted on. But in pursuing him on counts of sex trafficking and racketeering, the prosecution called 45 witnesses. What did you learn about Kelly's behavior through them?
In the case, there were basically six main witnesses. These stories clearly had a pattern. Kelly would somehow come in contact with these girls, and many of them were, you know, 16, 17, you know, when they were at his concert or at a meet and greet. And then Kelly would basically have one of his employees go up to them with kind of a invitation to call him. And they would. They were super fans. They were really interested in either furthering career or just getting to know a celebrity that they loved. And as a teenager, like, that's such an exciting thing. And then what would happen is that once they would kind of get to know Kelly, once they became part of his life, you know, he would invite them over to his house in Chicago or his recording studio in Chicago. And he would basically develop these abusive relationships with them. One of the things that every victim who testified said is that they were given instructions to follow a set of rules. And basically, the rules included call R. Kelly daddy, wear baggy clothing, don't look any other man in the eye, and ask Kelly for permission to speak, use the bathroom, or eat. And if they were to violate any of the quote-unquote rules, they would suffer the consequences. The consequences would sometimes be verbally berated by Kelly or sometimes physically assaulted.
To understand how R. Kelly got convicted, we need to go back a few decades to the long history of allegations against him and to the survivors who for years felt ignored when they tried to tell their stories. I spoke to Jim DeRogatis. He was a music critic for the Chicago Sun, more used to covering pompous rock bands and the city's rap scene, when he got the tip that would shape his career for the next two decades.
In November 2000, I got a letter anonymously sent via fax that was in response to a record review. I had reviewed R. Kelly's TP2.com, and I compared him to Marvin Gaye and Prince and Al Green, the other soul and R&B greats, and noted that, you know, there was always this tension between the freewheeling sexual escapades of Saturday night and being in church on Sunday morning with all of the greats. But R. Kelly, you know, it was particularly pronounced. And this anonymous correspondent said, look, you compared R. Kelly to Marvin Gaye. Marvin had his problems, but they're nothing like Robert's. Robert's problem is young girls.
So what did you think when you first read that fax? What went through your mind?
I will confess to you that I threw it in the slush pile. You know, Chicago's a very segregated city. Whenever I wrote about hip hop, I got these hate letters. You know, that's not music. That's just noise. And I thought here was somebody trying to bring down a super successful black superstar. But, you know, something about the facts bothered me and I was kicking myself. I had been a beat an investigative reporter in New Jersey at the start of my career. There was a level of specificity. There was some lawsuits mentioned that had never been reported upon. There was a name in the Chicago Police Department that had been investigating. And I called the Chicago Police Department switchboard, and I got connected to a Sergeant Chinahowski, and she says, oh, I was wondering how long it would be before someone called about that. I can't talk to you. And she hung up. And I took it to the city editor and I said, I think there's something here. And he paired me with the courts reporter, Abden Palish. And we found the first lawsuit that was filed by Tiffany Hawkins, victim number one, as far as I can tell.
So you, I mean, as you said, you've been writing about music and about R. Kelly for years. I mean, he's from Chicago. That was your paper. That's your city. But can you remind us also a bit more about what his persona and public status was like at that time?
From the very beginning, Kelly very craftily positioned himself with this R&B thug persona, taking some of the hip-hop pose and putting it together with the classic soul Lothario. And he's, you know, a fantastic story. He had risen from singing on street corners and the subway platforms for spare change to become the dominant voice in R&B in his generation. But his songs push the envelope in a new way, super sexually explicit, where an ordinary lover might give you foreplay. Kelly promised to give you 12 play because he was three times better. You know, he called himself a sexual super freak and the Pied Piper of R&B. You know, a particularly interesting nickname to adopt because the Pied Piper of legend, mythology, led a town's children to their death by playing his music.
But by 2002, he'd won three Grammys and he'd written and produced these hits for huge stars like Michael Jackson and for Jay-Z. His songs Bump and Grind and I Believe I Can Fly were cemented in the pop canon. He's a fully established superstar at this point. How did you feel about pursuing the story?
The first time I sat down with one of the women who'd been an underage victim, and she showed me the scars on her wrist where she tried to kill herself, it was never about him. For me, the story was about his victims. For 21 years, I've had young black girls tell me, nobody would listen to us. Nobody believes us. Will you tell my story? And, you know, look, I'm a fat white rock critic. I would rather be talking to you about Wire, my favorite band ever. But I don't think you're a journalist. If you get a call like that and you don't pursue the story, I don't think you're a human being. If you get a call like that from a woman who says, I need help, and you don't respond. People were saying the police ignored my story. I went to my principal at high school and she ignored my story. I went to my pastor and he ignored my story. Thank you for listening to me. And it was never a hard story to find. So the thing that always shocked us at the Sun Times was, where was the rest of the world's press corps? Why were we the only ones ringing doorbells on the South and West Side?
So there were a number of allegations by then that R. Kelly had been abusing young teenage girls, including Aaliyah, who was this 14-year-old R&B star that he'd mentored. And we've heard testimony in the trial in Brooklyn from Kelly's former tour manager that Kelly was so worried that he'd got an underage Aaliyah pregnant that he bribed officials to get a marriage license, making out that she was over the age of consent. As you carried on investigating him, what else did you find out?
We uncovered many stories of underage sex. Kelly would return to the high school he attended but never graduated, Kenwood Academy on the South Side. You know, he would go visit the choir class and pick up sophomores. He would hang out at the cheesiest restaurant I've ever been to in my life. It was the Rock and Roll McDonald's. The Hard Rock Cafe was across the street. So the biggest McDonald's in Chicago decided to hang a few fake gold records on the wall, and it was the Rock and Roll McDonald's. He had a regular table facing the door. He would pick up high school girls at the Rock and Roll McDonald's. He'd pick up girls wherever he went. The number of stories I heard about assistants passing on his phone number on little balled up pieces of paper that were pressed into the hands of young women at his concerts. And now, you know, we had a great length of testimony from two assistants who talked about sitting there and making up dozens of strips of this paper to hand out Kelly's phone number. You know, the stories were nonstop. He had a predilection for very young girls, and he had a predilection to tape himself in those encounters.
And you got hold of one of these tapes, didn't you?
Yeah, I was working at home in February 2002. So a little more than a year after the first investigative story, I was transcribing an interview with Alicia Keys. And I got a phone call because I was listed in the phone book. Go to your mailbox. And the voice, it was a gruff male voice, hung up. And in the mailbox was a plain, unmarked manila envelope with a video cassette. And I dreaded popping that into my VCR. And it was 26 minutes and 39 seconds, often reported incorrectly as grainy video. No, it was crystal clear. Kelly was unmistakable. The 14-year-old girl was unmistakable. We had seen pictures of her earlier. And, you know, he instructs her, call me daddy, do this, do that. He urinates in her mouth. And of course, there's sexual contact. It's the most horrifying thing I've ever seen.
So this video, which led to him being charged with 21 counts of child pornography in 2002, it was said by prosecutors to show him sexually abusing that underage teenage girl. It took 6 years for that case to come to trial, and he was acquitted. Dozens of allegations followed, but he was never convicted of anything. Why is that?
Why is that? We now know that Kelly bribed witnesses. He paid off the girl, her mother and her father, to lie to the grand jury, and he intimidated and threatened other witnesses. That trial is a farce. The judge ruled consistently for the defense. The judge made it about one girl on one tape, and despite the fact that it was shown in court 24 times, it was Father's Day weekend. The jury didn't want to be sequestered. They had never heard from the girl or her parents. They had heard from more than a dozen witnesses identifying the girl, Kelly, and saying, we knew about this relationship. Kelly, again, never hid. He would attend the girl's high school basketball games and sit in the stands, a man who was selling 100 million albums, sitting with a bunch of high schoolers cheering on his high school, quote unquote, girlfriend. Victim is the right word.
Well, hiding in plain sight, just right there in front of us.
Hiding in plain sight.
So if anything, this the trial actually emboldened him. Did you ever have the chance to confront music industry executives or his staff on why they weren't taking any of this seriously?
I've talked to plenty of low-level record company people, but the heads of Jive Records and Sony Music have always avoided taking my call or responding to my questions.
So you've never had a chance to speak to those music executives directly. It's worth saying that Sony, which bought Jive Records, did drop R. Kelly in 2019. The bosses didn't comment on why. But over the years, you continued to write stories and to speak to the women. But R. Kelly's career just never seemed to suffer. The critics carried on adoring him. He became even a kind of hipster icon in this last decade. What was it like watching that happen?
If I can switch into the music critic persona instead of the investigative reporter, it was enormously frustrating for me to see Pitchfork, to see Jezebel, an American feminist music publication, all championing Kelly and saying, despite that messy stuff, he's a musical genius. That messy stuff for me was always the girl who showed me where she tried to kill herself by slitting her wrists. It was a failing on the part of music journalism to never hold this man accountable. You know, he was never more successful than the period of those 6 years while he was waiting to go to trial. You know, Ignition Remix comes out in that period, and he never stopped. After the trial, he was only more emboldened to continue his behavior. You know, in 2013, there was, as you said before, hipster reevaluation. Pitchfork books him to headline at its music festival in Union Park on the West Side. You know, I watched that concert from backstage. It was half a mile away from where I'd sat with one of those girls. He performs at Coachella 2 weekends in a row with Phoenix. The white audience embracing him as sexual kitsch was particularly offensive, I think, because so many Black women had been saying for so long that this man devastated their community. Now, at the same time, the connection of the Black community in America runs deep. You know, I Believe I Can Fly was so many people's kindergarten graduation song. A Step in the Name of Love was everybody's wedding song. Ignition Remix powered every backyard barbecue people ever went to. And so the music was theirs as much as it was his.
Well, you talk about that sort of hipster reinvention, and you mentioned Phoenix, and I interviewed them at the time and brought up R. Kelly. And then one of the things that they sort of immediately said, and after saying, obviously, this is really problematic. And they're like, well, he's a musical genius. You know, the way that he writes and creates is something that we couldn't even do in a year, what he does in 2 minutes. And I do wonder, looking back at that now, I mean, this is as late as 2017, if his victims were white, do you think even the music industry would have stopped and taken notice and done something about this?
Yes, yes. You know, come on, Phoenix. And you know, but not alone. Lady Gaga, champion of her little monsters, feminist, gay rights icon, sexual assault survivor, records a song he writes. Do What You Want With My Body. Films not one, but two videos, one in which she's unconscious on an operating table and Dr. Kelly is about to operate on her. You know, Gaga knew better. Everybody knew better. But there was money to be made with this producer-songwriter with the Midas touch. And nothing speaks louder in the music industry. It is morally vacuous than money.
And I should say that Lady Gaga and Phoenix have both since apologized for working with R. Kelly. But that was only after more very high-profile allegations came out against him. Jezebel and Pitchfork have also apologized. But Jim, in 2017, you wrote a BuzzFeed piece revealing that Kelly had been keeping women in a so-called sex cult, where he controlled basically every aspect of their lives. What did you think it was about that article that cut through in a way that none of your reporting had until then?
That piece ran in July of 2017. In October 2017, the New York Times and the New Yorker simultaneously ran their exposés on Harvey Weinstein. And that launches the Me Too and Time's Up movements.
Mute R. Kelly! Mute R. Kelly!
The Mute R. Kelly movement launched shortly after that cult article, started by two brilliant activist women, Kenyetta Tisha Barnes and Oronike Odole. And they said, Black community, wake up.
I have never met anybody from the South Side of Chicago around my age group who does not have an R. Kelly story, and I live in Atlanta. So everybody knew. So it became harder and harder as we keep putting that mirror up to Chicago's face for them to keep denying what they were seeing back.
This man is victimizing your sisters, your daughters, your aunties for 30 years. Boycott any concert promoter who books him. Boycott any streaming platform or record company who releases his music, unless you approve of this behavior. Deny them your dollars and this man will stop.
So I think one of our biggest successes was working with activists here to get the Chicago concert shut down. Because of all the concerts, I thought there's no way.
And then on the wave of that sort of change in public mood, you had the Lifetime documentary Surviving R. Kelly, in which tens of women gave testimony on camera against him.
Treat me that way. I want my story to be heard so people could take this situation seriously. But when I found out it wasn't just me,
I just don't want it to get any worse.
And people that had known him throughout his early life and his career gave a picture of what he was like.
I had papers forged for them. But Aaliyah was underage. Got the marriage license and we were in a hotel in Maywood, Illinois. It was just a quick little ceremony, nothing elaborate. She didn't have on a white dress. Robert didn't have on a tux, just everyday wear. And Robert said, I do.
What impact did that show have, do you think?
At that point, 2019, January 2019, I had been reporting on Kelly for a mere 19 years. I had been sitting in so many rooms and coffee shops one-on-one with these Black women who were telling me how he had hurt them. And suddenly there were 12 total in both seasons of Surviving R. Kelly. Those women were in your living room. It was impossible to dismiss them as liars. And finally, literally within weeks of Surviving R. Kelly airing, the Homeland Security Department, the investigators for Homeland Security spread out across the country. And there were very few people I'd ever interviewed or reported on that they did not investigate. And that case is just amazing. I mean, it's 30 years of behavior charted out in a federal courtroom for the first time.
Jim, you've written about the fact that Kelly says he was sexually abused as a child by his sister, and you interviewed his siblings about it. In a 2016 interview that Kelly gave to GQ, he described that abuse as a generational curse, which was a pretty remarkable thing to say, given at that point he had been accused of multiple sexual offences against underage girls, you know, as if it was inevitable that a victim would become a perpetrator. What do you make of that?
I've interviewed a lot of experts on sexual abuse in my 21 years of reporting on this. And what has come back to me is that most survivors of sexual abuse as a child go on to become advocates for other victims. But some small percentage of those victims act out the way they were victimized and become abusers themselves. It's tragic. It's sad. It's horrible. But there are many, many victims of sexual abuse. And, you know, few of them act out with the audacity or are enabled to act out with the frequency of Kelly because of his money.
Money is something that Kelly can no longer wield as a weapon against his victims. Ahead of the trial in Brooklyn, his lawyers claimed Kelly was too broke to even afford transcripts of the case, which would have helped them work out a defense. In court, his defense team sought to portray Kelly as the victim of groupies, who they said had exploited him for his fame and for his wealth. Lauren, journalists and the public were barred from the courtroom because of COVID restrictions. So what's it actually been like to cover this case?
It's hard not to be able to be there in person, and really, especially when it comes to reporting on the witnesses who are testifying, to really get to see their emotions. Basically, you know, we were in an overflow room, us reporters sitting on a bench and then two screens kind of showing a view of the courtroom. They did have and I think you can see this in some of the courtroom drawings, you know, a special kind of camera pointed to Kelly so that you can kind of see him a little bit more closely. You know, in some cases, he was shaking his head. He did appear to be angry in some moments. Other moments, he appeared to be falling asleep.
Kelly decided not to speak in court to defend himself. But how did his lawyers try to defend him against the prosecution?
Kelly's lawyers made a big point to emphasize that these victims were once super fans, that they were aspirational musicians, and they were looking to Kelly for support in their careers. During cross-examination, Nicole Blankbecker, who is one of Kelly's defense lawyers, her line of questioning was, and this is a direct quote, "You chose to pick up every time he called." And then, you know, Stephanie, who is the witness who is testifying, said yes. And she then asked, "You could have chosen to get up and leave, you know, when she was in the studio. You consented to having sexual relationships with him every time." And that's when Stephanie responded, "I felt I didn't have a choice." And so, you know, you could get a sense from their line of questioning in cross-examination that they were trying to tell the jury, you know, these people, these witnesses made the choice to hang out with R. Kelly. They were the ones who chose to be in his presence. But then, of course, that completely ignores the power structure, the, you know, rules that he placed them under.
Coming up, what happens to R. Kelly now? Lauren, Kelly won't be sentenced until May next year. He's also facing charges in two other states, which he denies. What happens to him in the meantime? And what kind of prison term is he likely to face?
Kelly faces charges in Illinois state court and Minnesota state court, though the dates for those cases have not been set. But basically, you know, he is going to be in prison until he is sentenced. And then once he is sentenced, he could face 10 years to life in prison.
So, Jim, after this decades-long saga, at last, Kelly has been found guilty, at least of some offences. When you see that verdict, what do you think about today?
It's about the victims. It's not about anybody else. You know, the damage he did to them, the incurable sexual diseases he passed on to them, the post-traumatic stress, sometimes literally the scars. You know, it's too little too late. I think what we're all left with is, how was this man so incredibly popular, beloved, and wealthy, able to victimize so many women for so long? That's a tough one that society is going to have to grapple with, and my beloved art form of popular music is going to have to grapple with.
I'm not afraid of you anymore. I'm not afraid of your lawyers. I'm not afraid of your goons. I will not hide. You know what you did. You know the turmoil you brought into my kid's life. And not just my kids, my family. I would give my life for my justice in any other woman you validated.
That was Jim DeRogatis and Lauren Aretani with presenter Nosheen Iqbal. This episode was produced by Hannah Moore and Joshua Kelly, sound design by Axel Cacoutier. The executive producers of Today in Focus are Archie Bland and Phil Maynard. If this episode has brought up anything for you, please speak to someone. You can call the National Sexual Assault and Domestic and Family Violence Counselling Service on 1-800-737-732. That's 1-800-RESPECT. Their website is 1800respect.org.au, and they're available 24 hours. Okay, I'll be back with more episodes from Full Story tomorrow. Bye for now.